comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up, 200 U.S. soldiers land in Liberia and rebel forces hand over the port to peacekeepers. We'll have a report from Monrovia.
Also, is this week's arrested arms dealer a small fish in a much bigger pond? We learn about the present mother of all black market weapon salesmen, a Russian named Victor Boot.
And Saudi Arabia battling internal problems while launching a PR campaign abroad.
Our cultures may be different, but our goals are the same, striving for a better, safer world for all of us. A world open to new ideas and free from prejudice and intolerance.
These stories and your postcard poetry coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. About 200 American Marines have moved into the port area of Liberia's capital, Monrovia, to back up Nigerian peacekeepers. Earlier today, rebel forces pulled out of the port. NPR's Jason Bobian tells us the next step is to secure the area so humanitarian supplies can begin moving into the city.
The U.S. Marines and the Nigerian peacekeepers are moving through the port area, attempting to secure it from the lured rebels. There are huge crowds in the street. The bridges are still dividing the government-controlled side of Monrovia from what was the rebel-held side. And people on the government side are hoping to get across because there are huge food supplies that have been looted and that are available practically for free in the streets. The peacekeepers aren't allowing them to do that at this point because the peacekeepers want to set up some checkpoints. They want to set up some system of control to allow people slowly to go back and forth and to make sure that militias aren't moving across those bridges.
NPR's Jason Bobian in Monrovia. The U.S. military has apologized for sparking a protest in a Shiite district of Baghdad yesterday that left one Iraqi dead and four wounded. U.S. troops fired into a crowd after being attacked with a rocket-propelled grenade. Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, who commands the U.S. troops in Iraq, says the incident is being investigated.
The commander has gone in and said, we're not going to let this happen again. We'll take precautions. We understand that that's important to the people of Iraq. In fact, we have been on the ground working with the local leadership in order to ensure that we understand exactly what transpired there.
The incident has prompted a local Shiite Muslim group to demand that U.S. troops leave the neighborhood within 24 hours. President Bush is spending today and tomorrow in Southern California. His schedule includes two official events and two fundraisers for his reelection. NPR's Peter Overby reports.
As with many of his trips these days, the president is mixing politics with governing. In San Diego on Thursday, he'll visit with military families at Miramar Naval Air Station, and he'll attend a fundraising reception at the San Diego Convention Center. On Friday, Mr. Bush will tour the Santa Monica Mountains Recreation Area, an official visit, and he'll meet more campaign donors at a fundraising lunch in Irvine. The Bush-Cheney campaign doesn't like to reveal its dollar goals for fundraising events. On Monday, a reception in Denver grossed $1 million. The president is having absolutely no problems raising money. The campaign had gathered up more than $35 million as of the last reporting deadline, almost three times as much as the best-funded Democrat, Senator John Kerry. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials are up 41 points to 93.13. The Nasdaq is up 7 at 16.94. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the Commerce Department reports the trade deficit shrank in June. Americans bought a record $18.2 billion worth of foreign cars, but sales of other foreign-made consumer goods fell by about $1.25 billion. Meanwhile, U.S. exports rose 2.4% to slightly more than $84.5 billion. That's their highest level since June of 2001. However, the overall trade deficit remains on track to exceed last year's record. Alabama-based South Trust Bank has introduced a dress code for customers at its branches across the South. Steve Chiakakis with member station WBHM reports from Birmingham.
The policy is for customers. No dark glasses and no hats, helmets, or hoods. Not a fashion statement, they say, but a crime statement. The dress code stems from a test program Birmingham-based SouthTrust implemented in Florida a couple of years ago, saying it deters robberies. Anyone contemplating such a thing would avoid one of their branches because of the dress code. But they also cite a similar program in Massachusetts, where would-be bandits walked into a bank branch, abided by the dress code, robbed the bank, and were subsequently seen face uncovered on closed-circuit cameras. Most were apprehended a short time later. SouthTrust says it won't necessarily ask nuns, Orthodox Jews, or Muslim women to remove headdress, hats, or burkas, handling those cases individually. For NPR News, I'm Steve Chiatakis in Birmingham.
The producer price index rose by a tenth of a percent last month. Food prices fell and energy costs leveled off. The increase was in line with most analysts' expectations. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, now in its 25th year.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Tens of thousands of cheering Liberians looked on as rebel leaders handed over control of Monrovia's port today to U.S. Ambassador John Blaney. The handover coincided with the arrival of 200 American troops in the country, reportedly there to back up Nigerian peacekeepers and to facilitate the movement of food into this war-torn country. Nicole Itano is on the line from Monrovia. She's been covering the story for the Christian Science Monitor. Nicole, you were at the bridge this morning where this handover took place. What was it like?
Really was the most amazing outpouring of joy I've ever seen, and certainly the climax of this peace process has been going on here for several weeks. There were thousands and thousands of people there hoping to get across to the other side. For them, this really was the moment that meant that peace had come to Liberia.
And by the way, why was the handover to the U.S. ambassador? Why wasn't it to a Nigerian?
The force commander for the Nigerians was also there, but the ambassador, the U.S. ambassador, has really taken the lead role in negotiating the ceasefire, negotiating the withdrawal between the government and rebel troops. Mm. So he really has been out there in a negotiating capacity and has been the one doing the most communication.
Well, in addition to this incredible joy you mentioned, we also hear reports of looting. Tell us more about that.
The last day or so, on the rebel side, there's been really a frenzy of looting. There were thousands of people who made a last dash to the port where there still is quite a bit of aid food in warehouses there. And it was like a stream of ants of people just coming out carrying huge sacks of cornmeal and wheat. And at one point, the rebel troops came and scared away all the looters, saying that they wanted to restore order, and then went in and looted themselves.
Mm. We read, in fact, that some of the kicking and control was done by young children who were fighting for the rebels. Well, with that in mind, and with reports also of some fighting outside of Monrovia, what is your sense that the U.S. troops that are there now won't be involved in any combat, as the Bush administration is saying?
Well, I would be surprised if they were involved in any combat, primarily because they're just so much better armed and so much better trained than any of the forces here, whether rebel or government, that I think that any force here would be very reluctant to take on American troops. You know, you're not going to see American troops have to be in a combat situation because their mere presence here is enough to really stabilize the situation.
And, Nicole, one last question. You mentioned on this bridge where this handover took place, on one side were the government forces, on the other the rebel forces, and is there a sense that the incredible hatred between them is just going to dissipate now?
Certainly most people here, even most soldiers that I've talked to, want peace. They're happy about the intervention of the Nigerians and the American, and hopefully that will be enough to stabilize the situation. But the bigger concern is that you just have so many young armed men running around. The danger is less that they will try to restart the war than they will take those guns and use them for robberies or to terrorize civilians.
Mm. Well, Nicole, thank you.
Sure.
Nicole Itano of the Christian Science Monitor from Monrovia, Liberia. Well, to some observers, Liberian President Charles Taylor's exit into exile this week represented a turning point in Africa. African leaders and peacekeepers, in this case Nigerian, ushering Mr. Taylor out of the country, U.S. troops arriving later. But some say while power has changed hands in Liberia, nothing has really changed on the continent. Cruel leaders are allowed to stay in office, and neighboring armies are usually seen as invading forces, not peacekeepers. Joining us on the line is Jennifer Cook. She's Deputy Director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. And Jennifer, what are your thoughts? Is this a turning point?
Well, in some ways, I think the idea of African leaders kind of stepping up to the plate to put pressure on one another, for instance, provide peacekeepers in another country's conflict, is something of a new trend, or at least it's showing more promise these days. It's not entirely new, however. Nigeria intervened in Liberia in the mid-1990s, but became very entrenched with one side and was then accused of looting and robbing and complicit in many of the atrocities that happened.
Right. And in fact, there are countries that not only are accused but are actually doing that. I'm thinking of Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe, who entered the Congo conflict, and some say it was to steal the gold mines there.
Yes. Well, the Congo conflict is an example of up to seven states intervening in the Congo to kind of plunder and loot and pursue their own interests.
Well, some have said that African leaders have traditionally, and of course this is post-colonial leaders, traditionally taken a hands-off approach to other countries, because even if a leader like Robert Mugabe is considered corrupt, he's better than the white colonialists of Britain's Rhodesia, in that case, who preceded him.
Well, yes, and you see that President Mbeki is very hesitant to criticize President Mugabe because Mugabe is seen as kind of a liberation leader and so forth.
And President Mbeki of South Africa.
Of South Africa. But on the other hand, you have Mbeki being very forceful with Charles Taylor, for example. And so in many ways, I think we're starting to see African leaders recognize that they need to play a stronger role of peer review and peer pressure.
Hmm. What is your sense of the U.S. or outside role in African affairs from here on out? How has the Liberian case maybe been instructive?
Well, this has been becoming something of a model now. We have, for instance, in Sierra Leone, the British took a lead in conjunction with West African peacekeeping forces, and then a larger U.N. force coming in. Similar situation in neighboring Cote d'Ivoire, where the French took the lead. Here, the Nigerians have taken the lead, but the U.S. is playing this very important support role so far, and we hope that in October a larger U.N. force will come in. We can't really expect Africans to shoulder the costs of this kind of peacekeeping operation and long-term peacekeeping operation alone. And so I think this model of multilateralism with one key strong Western nation kind of playing the support role is a promising one.
Hmm. Well, Jennifer, thank you.
Thank you.
Jennifer Cook is Deputy Director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C.
Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge said today the sting operation that led to this week's arrest of arms dealer Hamant Lakhani should serve as a warning that the U.S. government is aggressively tracking down terrorist cells and black market weapons dealers. Lakhani is charged with trying to sell a shoulder-fired missile to an undercover agent. Light is shed on the shadowy world of arms dealers in a story in this Sunday's New York Times magazine. The article is called Arms and the Man, and it's about a 36-year-old Russian, a vegetarian, a loving father, something of a scholar named Victor Boot. Peter Landesman wrote the piece and joins us on the line now from Los Angeles. Welcome, Peter.
Thanks for having me.
You set out to meet the world's biggest arms dealer. You met a man named Victor Boot. Is he the guy?
Well, there's a lot of mythology about Boot. There are dozens of articles labeling him as the Satan, the monster, the single biggest source of weaponry in the world. And the answer to that question is yes, but Victor Boot might be the master builder of the largest global arms network. But he's really merely a mechanism for a much larger, darker force. And without sounding like a conspiracy theorist, what one has to understand about the arms trafficking market is that the market is directed by entrepreneurs, yes, but they really are the Federal Express of the network. The people directing these networks are work for governments, work indirectly for governments. They're in Moscow, they're in London, Paris, and Brussels.
Before we get to his overlords, then, tell us a little about Victor Boot. He's only 36 years old.
Victor is a remarkably compelling person. Other journalists have been unable to get to him, and so the picture that's painted is he's badly vilified. And, you know, again, he may be the criminal. I mean, he is the criminal, everybody says, but he's compelling. He's well-read. He's funny. There's some element of the mafioso in him, in his humor and his wit. And certainly, you know, it takes a thief to catch a thief. A man like Victor Boot, who's dealt with all the rebel leaders from Charles Taylor to Jonas Savimbi, you know, he might in some very odd way be in a position to be solving a lot of our problems.
You came away from this man, I don't want to say you liked him, but you found some humanity in him.
Yes. I mean, it's one of the disturbing things about being a journalist, that sometimes the people we vilify, we uncover as human beings. I expected to find the man who'd been written about, and what I found instead was someone who, with vast knowledge of human history, military history, and current geopolitics. Of course, you know, I spent almost a week with him, and I got to know him. I can't say quite well, but I'd say well enough to make a substantial judgment. The fact is that Victor Boot has a lot to say about the way geopolitics currently operates in the world.
Are you saying that a person like Victor Boot, then, is just taking advantage of a situation created by geopolitics? Countries do go to war, and that therefore he's somehow just an innocent player, a guy trying to make a buck?
No. Never call him an innocent player. He's an opportunist. He's in the business of making business. But he's certainly exploiting loopholes in arms trafficking laws that you could drive trucks through, and also the result of foreign policy throughout the 90s.
Is he a very wealthy man, Victor Boot?
It's impossible to know. You know, one must assume that he's a millionaire many times over. There's one Belgian intelligence report that says he made $50 million in Afghanistan. I think that intelligence report has, you know, been substantially discredited, so it's impossible to know.
Let's finish up with, not with Victor Boot, but with another name that emerged this week, Hemant Lakhani, man who was caught in a U.S. sting selling a shoulder-fired weapon to a U.S. Agent. Big player, small player, who is he?
Doesn't even register on the arms trafficking scale. This story will prove itself to be so trivial as to be completely forgotten for a number of reasons. One, you're talking about the sale of a single shoulder-fired missile, a deal set up under controlled circumstances. The seller was controlled, the buyer was controlled. This missile was going nowhere. And this guy, I've never come across him in dealing with Victor Boot or any other arms trafficker. Totally small fish. What this deal was it?
Well, he was dealing with a weapon that can bring down an airplane.
Well, let me put it to you this way. In the story on Sunday, I report an incident in which 300 of these weapons, these exact same weapons, were being sold by a Ukrainian quasi-company, really arms trafficker, to an American arms trafficker in Macon, Georgia. This was 2 weeks after 9/11. These weapons were on the way to the United States. The only reason they were stopped was some freak bureaucratic trivial check in Budapest, so the cargo was checked. Otherwise, these things would be here. And that was a total black ops situation. We didn't know who these people were. We barely know who the trafficker was on the buying end. He was just arrested 2 months ago. So we're talking 300 of these weapons in completely uncontrolled circumstances.
So you're suggesting, Peter, that this was a sting that was set up and virtually choreographed by U.S. agents doesn't really get to the question of whether we're getting the weapons that are not being brought out through a sting.
Well, to be fair to the U.S. government, I don't completely have the answer to that. I don't know the motivations, but I could just tell you this. We certainly needed good news like this. But I can also tell you this. I had a meeting in a Midwestern city with an accomplice to a very well-known arms trafficker, and we were talking about this case, and he just shook his head and started laughing uncontrollably. The people who know the arms trafficking business know exactly what this was, and this was, yes, a choreographed setup for good news.
Peter Landesman, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Peter Landesman joined us on the line from Los Angeles. His article about the arms dealer Victor Boot is in this Sunday's New York Times magazine.
Just ahead, some Americans ask Saudi Arabia who needs it. Some Saudis ask the same about us.
And later in the program, your Pitch Perfect postcard poems.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Saudi Arabia, immense oil reserves, immense problems. Where the U.S. gets about 10% of its oil, per capita incomes fallen from $20,000 20 years ago to $6,000 today. Turmoil within and from without. Troubled relations with Washington. Why Saudi Arabia launched a PR campaign on U.S. radio stations.
On May 12th, Al-Qaeda terrorists struck deep into the heart of Saudi Arabia. Why? The terrorists understand that Saudi Arabia is one of America's largest trading partners and strongest supporters in the Middle East. Both countries are working closely to bring peace and prosperity to this region. In both countries, terrorists have tried to tear apart our friendship. But the terrorists will not be allowed to win.
This message is brought to you by the people of Saudi Arabia, allies against terrorism.
A commercial currently running on American radio stations. Well, we're going to speak now to two experts on Saudi Arabia. First, to get a sense of how Washington sees the U.S.-Saudi relationship at this point, we're joined by Greg Gause, director of the Middle East Studies Program at the University of Vermont. Welcome, Greg.
Good afternoon.
Well, Greg, Saudi Foreign Minister Prince Saud al-Faisal rushed to Washington for a meeting with President Bush last month, as you know, to demand that the White House declassify 28 pages of a congressional inquiry into the 9/11 attacks. What was that all about?
Saud al-Faisal and I think people at the top in Saudi Arabia feel that they're being unfairly branded with all sorts of accusations since 9/11, but particularly since the release of the congressional report, and they feel that they can't respond to them because they don't know what they are.
Members of Congress, of course, have said that these redacted pages are very damning for Saudi Arabia, indicate that Saudis may have helped fund the 9/11 hijackers. Why would the foreign minister want such a thing released?
I think he wants to be able to establish that even if there were Saudis involved, it wasn't the Saudi government or high-level officials in the Saudi regime, which is the implication of at least some of the speculation about the redacted material.
So what's the state of U.S.-Saudi relations? This very old relationship seems more troubled than ever before.
I think it's certainly more troubled than at any time since the oil embargo of 1973-74. I think that in some ways it's healthy because in the last 10 years we've had in many ways, an overly close relationship with Saudi Arabia. This might be a move, hopefully, back to some level of normality, but there is a risk, given the hostility toward Saudi Arabia in the U.S. and the hostility toward the United States and public opinion in Saudi Arabia, that the relationship could spin out of control.
Where is the hostility coming from? I note that the cover and two main articles in the very pro-Bush Weekly Standard magazine this week roughly arguing these two articles, that Saudi Arabia, who needs it?
I saw one of those articles on oil. I think it was way off the mark. There are two major constituencies in the Republican Party who have decided that the Saudis are, as it were, enemies. One is the intellectual constituency of the neoconservative movement, and another is the religious right, which is a large voting bloc in the Republican Party. Both, since 9/11, have basically taken the position that Saudi Arabia is not only not a worthy ally, but perhaps an enemy of the U.S.
Greg, why doesn't the president simply release those 28 pages that the foreign minister of Saudi Arabia says release? We're not afraid of it.
Well, I wish I knew. I think that there's a tendency in this administration to overclassify. I mean, the question is not why do they classify in their minds, it's why do we release? And the claim is that there's an ongoing investigation, which is certainly true. But it seems to me that given the pressures, particularly in Congress, eventually we're going to see what's on those pages.
Yeah. Well, Greg Gause, thanks very much for joining us.
Sure, my pleasure.
Greg Gause is director of the Middle East Studies Program at the University of Vermont. Well, we turn now to an old friend of Here and Now, Yousef Ibrahim. He's an energy and political analyst who's a frequent visitor to Saudi Arabia. He joins us from New York. And welcome, Yousef.
Good afternoon.
Yousef, hostility seems to be high in Saudi Arabia as well toward the U.S., to the point where there's a faction among the top princes threatening to sell Saudi Arabian oil to the world in euros instead of dollars, which, of course, could be economically a really bad thing for the United States.
Yes, and also remember that Senator Schuman of New York has suggested that Prince Naif be removed from power. So this is pretty bad when you reach the point where you have a senior member of the Saudi royal family that is declaring what is tantamount to a casus belli. I mean,
right.
Shifting from the dollar to the euro would deal a blow to the dollar at a time where the American economy is in dire straits.
You know, there's something of a battle for the soul of Saudi Arabia, is there not, on the highest levels between Crown Prince Abdullah, the de facto head of state, and Prince Nayef bin Abdul Aziz, the interior minister. Tell us about that.
I would say that this competition has diminished significantly in the last 6 months, and the family is drawing together and closer around Abdullah, precisely because they do feel this fierce attack from members of Congress and the Senate and the neoconservatives, but also because the war in Iraq has resolved many issues for them. For example, it has gotten the United States Army out of there. It has also eliminated the threat from Iraq. And there is a question in Saudi Arabia which says, why do we need American protection? I mean, the deal was we give them oil, they give us protection. In 5 or 6 years from now, our biggest oil client is going to be China, which is devouring oil like there's no tomorrow. And maybe what we should start reconsidering our strategic options.
So where is this relationship going when powers that be in both Washington and Saudi Arabia are saying we don't need them?
It is changing. It is no longer going to be the marriage we used to have. I'm not prepared to say it's going to be a divorce, but we are certainly going towards a sort of separation that will evolve perhaps into a new relationship. Let's say like a couple will be sleeping in different bedrooms.
Yousef Ibrahim, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Yousef Ibrahim is an energy and political analyst who's a frequent visitor to Saudi Arabia. He joined us from New York.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up 50 years later, a lawsuit to desegregate the schools of Baton Rouge is finally coming to a close. Today, 3 out of 4 students are black.
Plus, New York City's proposed Harvey Milk High School will be for gay and lesbian students. But Harvey Milk's nephew says his pioneering uncle would have disapproved.
Harvey was not about segregation. He was about getting people into the mainstream society equally, whether you be gay or anything else.
And postcard poetry. You mailed this one in.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Marianne Nichols. Dozens of American Marines have landed in Liberia, and rebels are giving up control of their territory in Monrovia to peacekeepers. This ends a 2-month siege of the country's capital and comes just days after Liberian leader Charles Taylor went into exile. Glenn McKenzie reports from Monrovia.
Peacekeepers came in over the bridge from the government side. They rounded up the rebel troops and escorted them out of the port area. There didn't seem to be much violence, although there was some shooting in the air by rebel troops who seemed in a jovial mood and seemed to be enjoying the celebrations that had already begun on the streets by civilians looking forward to the imminent reunification of the two sides.
One of the priorities for peacekeepers now, distributing food and other aid to thousands in Monrovia. Many have had little or nothing to eat for several days. The commander of U.S. ground forces in Iraq says the military is investigating a deadly incident in Baghdad yesterday when American forces fired on thousands of protesters in a Shiite Muslim neighborhood. U.S. officials say the troops fired only after a rocket-propelled grenade was fired at them. At least one person was killed when Iraqis gathered around a communications tower where they say American troops in a helicopter tried to tear down an Islamic banner. U.S. Commander Ricardo Sanchez says it appears the helicopter blew down the banner.
We all make mistakes sometime, just like the enemy is making mistakes and killing Iraqis, which I'm sure they don't intend to do. Sometimes we're making mistakes also. But when we do, we'll take care of that.
Shiite Muslims are calling on the Americans to leave their neighborhood in 24 hours. The French government says the 2-week heat wave in that country has directly or indirectly caused about 3,000 deaths. Officials are calling it a veritable epidemic and say many of the victims were elderly. Many people died while locked inside apartments, raising concerns about hygiene and odor. One police union is calling on the government to deploy soldiers to retrieve bodies. Authorities are cleaning up after a 6.4 magnitude earthquake on islands in western Greece today. The quake's epicenter was about 20 miles off the Ionian Islands. Residents and tourists clogged the main bridge as they fled the islands. On Wall Street at this hour, stocks are up. The Dow is up 48 points at 93.20. The NASDAQ is up 12 points at 16.98. And the S&P is up 7 points at 9.91. It's 33 past the hour.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Nearly 50 years ago, 14 local families signed on to a lawsuit that called for the Baton Rouge School District to comply with the U.S. Supreme Court's 1954 decision in Brown versus the Board of Education. The ruling held that separate schools for black children was inherently unequal. But not much changed in Baton Rouge after the Brown decision. The question today, what will change now that District Judge James Brady's expected to sign an agreement ending the East Baton Rouge desegregation suit? Well, joining us on the line is Tulane University Professor Carl Bankston. And Professor, why has it taken so long for this suit to be settled?
In part, it's because the East Baton Rouge Parish School Board did not do a great deal to live up to the demands of desegregation from 1956 through the 1980s.
What is the state of the Baton Rouge schools today? I understand that the lawsuit was largely ignored until 1981, when a new district judge was so appalled at what he saw in the schools that he then ordered busing, and then all the whites started leaving. So what has this all meant for the district?
Funding is somewhat more equitably shared today than it was in 1980. Unfortunately, the amount of funding to go around has shrunk as support for the school system has gone down. One of the problems is that since the beginning of active desegregation in the early 1980s, there's been such tremendous white flight from East Baton Rouge Parish that a truly desegregated school system has now become impossible to achieve. And so those who are demanding a desegregated school system have been demanding an impossible goal. To give you an example of what's happened, in 1965, East Baton Rouge Parish was approximately 39% African American and the rest effectively white. And between 1981 to 2003, it went from approximately 60% white to close to today 75% African American.
Has there then, in a sense, been simply a resegregation of the schools with white and middle class flight and despite magnet schools?
Oh, yes, indeed. There has been a resegregation of the schools. Most of the white students in East Baton Rouge Parish have moved to Livingston or Ascension parishes, where there are lines of teachers wanting to go to work there. In East Baton Rouge Parish, however, by the late 1990s, about a third of schools and many of the minority-dominated schools were staffed by non-certified teachers. Also, today, a majority of the white students who remain in Baton Rouge Parish are now in the non-public system.
So the melancholy reality is that nearly five decades to get this decision, it's not going to make that much difference to the kids, right, nor to the reality of segregation in parts of Baton Rouge.
Exactly. The students who left are not going to come back. Families that have settled in the surrounding suburbs are not going to say, okay, the court case is over in Baton Rouge, let's sell our homes and move there. Those who are in the non-public school system, they're not likely to move back. I would say this might slow white flight from East Baton Rouge Parish, but at some point in the future, we're probably looking at an all-African-American school system.
Professor, thank you very much for joining us on this.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Carl Bankston, professor at Tulane University.
In New York City, a state senator and a conservative group filed a lawsuit yesterday saying that a new public high school for gay, bisexual, and transgender students violates laws against segregation. The school will open this fall to all students, but it's being built and financed specifically to protect students in the gay community. The school is officially called the Harvey Milk High School, after the late openly gay San Francisco politician Harvey Milk. And Andy Milk, nephew to the slain gay rights pioneer, says his uncle would also disapprove of the school, but for perhaps a different reason than others. Hello, Andy.
Hello.
And tell us, why do you think your uncle, Harvey Milk, would have disapproved of New York City's first school for gay students?
Harvey was not about segregation. He was about getting people into the mainstream society equally, whether you be gay or anything else. This school represents going back 25-plus years to what he tried to tear down, these boundaries. The closet, the wall, whatever you want to call it, and he did a very good job tearing that boundary down. Now you're going ahead and resurrecting what he tore down. Mm.
To remind people, the proposed school grew out of a two-classroom program that was integrated into the school system. Do you think he would have supported programs like that, the Safe Schools program that many communities still have?
I think he would have supported these programs within the school. We have these programs now for different types of education, for different kids with different problems. But they're in the main society of the school, of the environment.
Andy, did anyone from the New York City schools ask your family if they could use Harvey Milk's name?
No, they have not.
How do you feel about that?
It's troublesome because, you know, we bear the name. We don't know what the driving force is behind this or who that particular person or people are, and what was their relationship with Harvey. I think none.
Yeah. You bear the name. Your uncle was killed by Dan White in 1978. He also killed the mayor of San Francisco, George Moscone. He pleaded the infamous Twinkie defense. He said he was on junk food, but that aside, you were 21 years old that year. You say you bear the name, but other people embraced Harvey Milk, especially after he was assassinated. Do you remember the incredible outpouring the day that he died?
Absolutely. My father and mother did go to San Francisco, and one of the reasons they were there was to try to calm down or to ease the tension of hostilities.
Thousands of people poured into the streets that day bearing candles. It was quite a time. Do you think that ultimately Harvey Milk and what he stands for sort of is maybe going to belong to other people?
What he stood for belongs to part of history. You know, he was someone who was, in his own right, his own martyr, or, you know, for these rights for everybody, not just in, we can't lose track of that. He was not just for gay and lesbian, primarily, yes, but he was also for minorities, too.
Mm-hmm.
If you probably look at some of the staples of what he was trying to impress upon people, you'll see similarities even with Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm. If the school gets built and if the name goes up, you're in New York, how are you going to feel with the name there on that building?
I don't know if there's much I can do about that. If you want to honor the man, you can, but not in this way.
Andy, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Andy Milk, nephew to slain gay rights leader Harvey Milk.
Still to come, looking to send a postcard this summer? Perhaps you'll be inspired by our listeners' postcard poetry.
You're listening to Here and Now. It's Thursday when we open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
Our discussion on the increase in job losses, even as the economy recovers, prompted Amanda Ellsworth of Groton, Massachusetts to write, "What wasn't mentioned is the increase in the number of hours most salaried workers are putting in without getting paid for them. In the era of massive layoffs, the remaining workers are expected to pick up the slack. Fewer workers doing more work for the same pay equals increased productivity. For how long can this false increase in productivity continue before our workforce burns out?"
Listener Joseph Gallucci of Phoenix, Arizona, had a couple of questions after hearing an interview we did with West Nile virus expert Roy Campbell. Joseph writes, "The doctor mentioned that there are some mosquito repellents that are very good, but I didn't hear any. He also mentioned that the West Nile virus is deadly if the virus attacks the brain, and there are symptoms one should look out for. Again, I listened intently for those symptoms, but again, I didn't hear any. Sorry." Dr. Campbell recommends two types of repellents, those which contain DEET or permethrin. However, permethrin can only be used on clothing, not skin. And according to the CDC, the symptoms of West Nile infection include high fever, neck stiffness, stupor, convulsions, muscle weakness, paralysis, and coma.
Another story on how several of the men involved in the Iran-Contra scandal are now in positions of power drew this call from Lenore Fenn of Lexington, Massachusetts.
It was really sanity-making to have these things talked about, recognized, acknowledged, and terrifying also to realize that they're in place precisely because they were good at lying to Congress and manipulating the system. Very, very disturbing, but at least it was acknowledged.
Ed McCumber of New Bern, North Carolina, wrote after our story on U.S. Administrator Paul Bremer's comments that the money to rebuild Iraq might run out. So we called Mr. McCumber and asked him to express his concerns.
Iraq is a country rich in oil resources, and while most of those resources haven't been reconstituted, eventually this country will be able to begin to supply more oil sources for export, and that's going to mean more revenue, and I believe that a lot of this revenue could be used to the rebuilding. The interview left at least the feeling in my mind that the U.S. taxpayer would have to foot this bill largely.
Right. And you have a personal interest in the rebuilding and reconstruction of Iraq?
Yes, I do. My son is in the military. I want to see him safe, and I want to see all of our people safe.
Well, Ed, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin. And please continue as you have, because I get more information out of your show in 1 hour than I do all day of everything else.
Thanks, Ed. And this note, Lois in Auburn, New Hampshire, asked about the song following our story on literature of cultural collisions. Well, it was Crash Into Me on the Dave Matthews Band CD, Crash.
Lost for you, I'm so lost for you. Oh, when you come crash into me. Come into you.
As always, we love when you crash into us. Our email address is letters at here-now.org. That's letters at here-now.org.
Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
In 1993, something happened to Wynn Cooper that a poet usually only dreams about. His verse was heard and adored by millions, thanks to pop musician Sheryl Crow.
All I want to do is have a little fun before I die.
Lyrics to this Grammy-winning song, All I Want to Do Is Have Some Fun, are actually lines from Wynn Cooper's poem titled simply Fun. Well, flash forward 10 years to today. Wynn Cooper is still writing from his home in Vermont, and right now one of his favorite forms is the postcard poem. He's written over 150 of them over the past 2 years, enough to fill 2 books. Cooper also has a record deal, setting some of these brief, impressionistic pieces to music. Well, for our latest poetry challenge, we asked listeners to send us their compact, bite-sized pieces of verse, and in addition to their submissions, we received Wynn Cooper's new chapbook, Secret Address, which is filled with postcard poems. So before we turn to Here and Now's own roving poets, Jim Burley and Molly Sicardo, let's hear from postcard poet Wynn Cooper about his affection for the form.
Well, I think just it's that they're different. They're often short and snappy. Some of them are longer. Some of them are prose poems. They're often from a specific place. They have often a historical dimension to them, but they always become personal at some point in the way that a postcard is.
Yeah. How did you stumble on the genre?
Well, a former student of mine, this fellow named Josh Harmon, was teaching at Bucknell University and running their literary magazine called West Branch, and he received two postcard poems during the same week, unsolicited, from two different writers, one from Cape Cod and one from Topeka, Kansas, I believe. And so that gave him the idea that he would call a bunch of his poet friends and ask them to write postcard poems from the towns in which they lived. So I wrote one from Halifax, Vermont, which is where I live, and it was so much fun and so easy that I just kept going and ended up writing postcards from states of mind, you know, postcard from desire and things like that. And I'm still writing a few. I haven't quite exhausted it yet.
Well, let's hear one.
Okay. This one is called Postcard from Hell. I'm less than an hour northwest of Ann Arbor, on the second most winding road in Michigan. Hell is perched on a hill above a man-made lake, 40 or so houses, a few stores, and Dam Creek, which runs under the intersection. Postcards in the store say, "Greetings from Hell, welcome to Hell, go to Hell." The guy pumping my gas tells me about the weathermen on the Detroit TV stations, how they try not to laugh when they report every November that hell froze over last night. I am cold without you, not burning in hell like I expected to be.
There really is a hell.
Yes, there is. I grew up near there, as a matter of fact.
You say that as a poet, you enjoy writing them, and they seem to flow out. And we certainly have had an outflow of postcard poems from our listeners. We put out our poetry challenge last time. So thanks very much, Wynn, for helping us set up that segment with our listeners, and thanks for your postcard poems.
Well, thank you, Bill.
Vermont poet Wynn Cooper's new chapbook of postcard poems is called Secret Address. Here and Now's roving poets, Molly Sicardo and Jim Burley, are in the studio now to read through some of our listener postcard poems. Hi, Jim. Hi, Molly.
Greetings, Bill.
I'm hoping Wynn will hook me up with Sheryl Crow.
Well, you know, do wonders for a poet's future. Molly, this was a really popular poetry challenge, many written on actual postcards in addition to dozens emailed to us. You surprised?
No, because people love to send postcards anyway, and it was a short, accessible form, and everyone likes to talk about where they are. And it was interesting, a lot of them talked about being in one place and thinking about another or going from one place to another. 16-year-old girl, Anna Bacceci, B-A-C-C-E-I, sent us one. Here, sun and shade are the same species. Somewhere, a bamboo Buddha smiles enshrined. A sacred someone waits in the hereafter. But here, the beaches are egg-like among the firs. The coreopsis has meek spindles. The meadow runneth over. Time is sound. A pond is lost and found.
That's an amazingly delicate, kind of sophisticated poem for a 16-year-old.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty nice.
Jim, have you got a favorite?
I do, and Molly's a genius for suggesting this, let me just say, because there's, like, postcards all over the place here.
Yeah.
I mean, we're probably getting more right now as we speak.
Yeah.
This is from Rachel Port. She's from Arizona. These are called her seasonal postcards. One, Arizona spring, clouds of Palo Verde, and the smell of bug spray. Two, summer, an open kitchen door, a bird hops in and hops out again. Three, finding one yellow tree in the desert leaves me thirsting for autumn. Four, approaching brief snow, the puppy sniffs, growls, and gets ready to pounce. Now, I had no idea that it was actually possible that it could snow in Arizona. So this was a very informative postcard poem as well.
Though you are cheating just a little there. It's really a greeting card you've got there.
It was so big, yeah.
But a nice poem. Another nice poem from listener Meredith Truesdale from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Meredith's little ode to summer weather came to us on a postcard with a picture of a brown pelican on it. That's the Louisiana state bird.
It rained this summer. Hard, soft, gentle downpours. Then lashing, swinging drops. The trees ached no more. Leaves grew fat. Time drifted differently. Louisiana was home again.
Little hard for us to relate to up here in the Northeast since it's been raining incessantly since about January. But,
I understand that. Yeah, we need to trade spots. We're having a rainy summer, but right now we're having a few dry days.
Well, Meredith Truesdale, thanks so much for your postcard poem.
Thank you.
We did hear from listeners all over the country. We got one from Patricia Bowen in Tucson, Arizona, the Aspen Fire, a few from P. Lawrence in Oswego, New York.
From Alicia Rando of Sharon, Massachusetts. Young waves craving the shore's call to adventure, race carrying pockets full of marine treasures, then empty, thinly lick the sand and answer mother's call to return. The postmark is from Providence, Rhode Island, and the postcard itself is from the Breakers in Newport, Rhode Island. So she's on vacation, maybe.
You know, a number of the postcard poems we got were homemade. Valerie Spain of Watertown, Massachusetts, was one of those. She wrote about a trip to Europe. Her postcard, a beautiful handmade work of art.
It's a collage of various pieces of papers and such that I brought back from Paris. I was there at the end of June, and I'm a collage artist, so this is the kinds of things I create.
Well, let's hear your poem.
Okay. It's titled In Paris. In Paris, I did not wear blue, but I carried a sun-yellow basket and filled it with bread and cheese. I came to your house in Brittany, and we toured the old walled cities. You took me to the top of Mont Saint-Michel. The tide was out. We were surrounded by bare and shifting sands.
You know, it's interesting. A postcard is a picture, naturally, and then some words, but a postcard poem, in a way, is a picture, too, isn't it?
Yeah, I like to be very visual with my poetry images, and, yeah, I think that certainly my poetry is very visual.
Well, Valerie Spain, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be here.
That was a great one, the images of Paris in the poem and on the postcard.
Yeah, it was just the whole thing was a little composition, both sides. And we want to thank all of our listener poets for taking up our latest poetry challenge. To view some of the submissions, please go to our website, here-now.org. That's HERE-NOW.org. And thanks, as always, to you, Jim and Molly.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Cridell, Stefano Katsonis, Emiko Tamagawa, and Jordana Gustafson. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Matt Odette. Our web producer is Zach Christo, and our intern is Allison Vence.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
I like a good beer buzz early in the morning, and Billy likes to peel the labels from his bottles of Bud. He shreds them on the bar, then he lights every match in an oversized pack, letting each one burn down to his thick fingers before blowing and cushioning them out. He's watching the bottles of Bud as they spin on the floor, and a happy couple enters the bar.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories, Here and Now.
The director of Pumping Iron will have a no...
Here and Now.
The director of Pumping Iron will have a no...